I think I've discovered a cure for after-the-meal drowsiness. Give a talk. For those of you who haven't been on a Thanksgiving retreat for the past couple of years, this is Lungpa Pasno has offered the opportunity for a few of us to share in the afternoon reflections. And so it's starting the round here with myself. And just wanting, first of all, just to express how good it feels to be back again this year. The past couple of years I've been accompanying the crew here, and it's been a very enjoyable retreat, just to be here with a lot of old friends and a few unfamiliar faces, but many familiar faces, and just walking the path with a number of people over many, many years, 15 years since, 16, I guess, 17 years since the monastery opened, and knowing some of you even before that time. So it always feels like a great reunion in a way. This one's especially fun for me, or good for me, because some of you know I've got my sister here. She's hiding out there in the back row. And this is first time she's come out for a retreat like this, so it's just a real delight to have her here as well. And I was just thinking about what to talk about, and Lungpa's talked about a few themes since the beginning of the retreat, and touched again this morning on some thoughts that included some reflections around impermanence, and I thought I'd just spend a little bit more time on that, offer a few thoughts that I've had around that. There's a lot of different aspects or angles to when we're contemplating impermanence. It kind of is a reflection that crosses many different areas of our lives and our practice. And Lungpa kind of was talking some around using it in meditation practice and as a basis for really developing some deep insight and seeing it in conjunction with the selflessness of phenomena, using it as a basis for the development of insight into anatta, not self. And that is its most profound application, is when we take it to that level that leads us to the gates of to the deathless, essentially. It's also a reflection that is used on maybe a bit more of a motivational, or one could say, I guess, a coarser level, although it certainly really isn't coarse in the common usage of the word, but more along the lines of a reflection that helps us gain some motivation for practice, sort of developing a sense of commitment or zeal, chanda, in our practice, so that it's a motivating force, giving us a sense of urgency, sangwega, a sense of urgency in our practice, when we really consider some of those aspects of impermanence. One of the ways that the Buddha suggested that we reflect on our experience is looking at what he called the heavenly messengers, which most of you are probably familiar with, the messengers of the ideas of old age, sickness, and death as primary motivating forces in getting us to look at our lives in a bit more of a serious way. And those three recollections are based on this contemplation of impermanence, that we're all subject to these changes, as much as we would like to try and avoid getting older and all the things that accompany aging, as much as we would like to avoid illness because of its discomfort, its unpleasantness, the pain that's involved with illness, as much as we'd like to not even think about the idea of death. All of these are messengers that cross our lives every now and then in our personal experience, whether it's with ourselves or with other people that we know. And they're all trying to call our attention to the realities of life, the aspect of changeability, of impermanence, and of course unsatisfactoriness as well. It's a hard one. We don't want to look at these kinds of things, but if we avoid them, then we just end up living life in kind of a dreamlike state and ignoring certain realities that sooner or later come on us, whether gradually or all of a sudden. And if we haven't put much attention to them, then they take us by surprise and can cause a lot of pain and despair. But if we do take the opportunity to see these as heavenly messengers, something that's calling our attention to wake up, then when they come upon us in full force, then we're much more able to swing with these vicissitudes of life as a human being. And I was just, as we were talking about earlier, you know, looking across the people in the room, a good number of us are getting on in years. I suspect a substantial majority are over the age of 50 here. A few people in their 30s and 40s, but and 20s. But there's a lot of aging going on, so it's a time that a lot of us start to ponder this a bit more. It's kind of staring us in the mirror every morning. And it's also with Gail, my sister, visiting, I've noticed that it always brings up certain kinds of memories of a life lived. She's the one person in this room who I've known since I was born. And there's a lot of history there that comes up, just being in each other's presence. A lot of memories of childhood, growing up together, a certain family, with our brother as well as our mother and father. Memories of the city we grew up in, the house we grew up in, and all the activities that we engaged in, as most families do, growing up with neighbors next door to us and going to school and the different friends that we shared, next door neighbors and people from school, classrooms, teachers. I could probably remember the name of every teacher I had. They make such an indelible impression on you when you're growing up. So those memories from childhood are very strong and kind of start to form part of an identity of who we think we are as people in the world in relation to all of those different things that we grow up with, people we grow up with. You know, and on through teenage years when you're starting to really form a sense of who you think you are, a sense of identity. And, you know, even then into early adulthood, establishing relationship and career and identification around a household or a profession, all of those kinds of things. And I look back at that and I think, you know, there's a lot that's happened in 57 years. That's how old I am. And coming to the monastery, of course, is a big big turning event at around the age of 40. And just reflecting on how many lifetimes we live in even just one life. You know, we think of this as one life that we're in right now. From the time we were, quote, born from our mother's womb. And there's all sorts of memories and perceptions that we piece together to form this perception or concept of my life. And we, you know, think of it as sort of this discrete occurrence. This is one lifetime. But looking back and just thinking about who I was or who I think I was when I was a child, you know, a sense of developing self-perception, and how that slowly changed and morphed over many years through teenage years and through early adulthood and on to middle age. Yeah. How many lifetimes are there really in that, just even in that 57 years? You know, can I say that it was me back then, just as it is me right now? Is it the same me as it was? Things have changed so much. I think all of us can relate to that. You know, can you really say that you were the same person back then that you are now? How many lifetimes have you lived? Not to mention the fact that, you know, all the previous lifetimes, the innumerable and uncountable, unfathomable number of lifetimes that, that we've lived that we have no memory of. At least most of us probably don't have any memory of them. Can we say that's who we really were? Was I really, you know, the same person over these countless number of lifetimes? So just reflecting on that changing nature of self-perception of who we are in relation to the world. And as we, as time goes on, that's, and if, particularly if we reflect on it, that sense of continuity starts to become a bit fuzzier if we're really honest. You know, I think that the tendency, I used to work a lot with older adults when I was working as a nurse, as well as with hospice, but also just in general with older adults. And you see this tendency, I think, sometimes as people get older, that as things start to look a little more uncertain for the future, you know, as old age and the impending end of life starts to become more conscious as we get older, if there's a lack of consideration around the issues of change and impermanence, if there's kind of a not wanting to see that, if there's a basis in fear, then you can see how sometimes people start to live in the past. They start to not want to be in the moment because the moment's starting to look a bit scary. What's going to be happening over the next 5, 10, 15 years, how many ever years you have left as you get into your older years. There can be this tendency to kind of not look at that and to revert to just living from the past, living from the old successes, the old accomplishments, the old relationships, really good, oftentimes at filtering out some of the more difficult times that we had and dwelling with, recounting past good times, past memories. It's more pleasant to think of those times as who we are or who we were, as, you know, identifying with that now, so that there isn't the need to look at what's coming up around the corner. Yeah, it's interesting that even sometimes as people start to lose some of their memory through different kinds of mental changes, cognitive changes, that oftentimes what you see is the ability to have short-term memory that starts to become a lot more difficult, remembering things that are recent, but that the long-term memories tend to stay pretty fixed and become much more of a part of a person's daily realities, these memories from the past. So it's almost like there's this kind of built-in mechanism to, you know, give a sense of security or a sense of stability, a sense of reliability in what we think of as our lives, who we think we are as we get older. But really, when you start to reflect on it and start to think about the past, think about when you were younger or when you were just starting your career. These are also projections, because our memories are often aren't very reliable. It's really common, I think, knowledge that we can create a past that wasn't necessarily exactly the way we remember it. If Gail and I were to sit down and go over a number of events from the past, we'd probably find out that we didn't even remember some of the things that the other one remembered, and that our view of a particular series of events or times in life are quite different, because our realities are very much constructed from our own basis of observation. One event can look very different from two different sides. So that even trying to rely on past events as a way of stability is, fraught with inaccuracies. It's basically just projections based on our own filtering mechanism. So I found it often useful to just sort of often consider that as I'm contemplating life and the way things are, just to really think, really the past, the childhood, the adolescence, the middle years, really are just sort of in the mist. They're just sort of vaguely fleeting memories that aren't really worth holding on to, because there's really no substantiality in them. They are just memories. They're not real events anymore. And it's just not worth spending the time trying to reconstruct or to build a sense of security or identity around them, constantly changing. When you reflect on that, it just aids in that process of relinquishment, of letting go, of depending on that as a place of refuge. And you can actually bring that into more of the present too. It doesn't have to be way back into the early parts of our lives. Just the more you use that as a reflection, the more you can really help turn your attention more towards a present moment kind of awareness. Just remembering, actively recollecting what your life was like just a few years ago. Are you the same person that you were even just a few years ago? What's different now? Maybe even just last year or a month ago. All of it's just a memory. And if you hold on to that as who you were, then you're just clinging to a perception. It might be a little disconcerting, a little scary to try and let go of some of those senses of who I am or who I think I am from the past, because it feels a little bit ungrounding to move right into the moment now and not holding on to the past. But it's also very freeing. Not to carry the baggage of the past around. There's so much that, so many ways that we carry our old habits through memories, through perceptions, the old habits that cause us suffering, the ways we react in the world, based on these ways of reacting and acting. So looking at these three messengers, old age, sickness, and death, can help pull us into the moment as well. There's in the past couple of years, it seems like there's been a lot of opportunity for many of us around the monastery, friends, of the monastery to particularly look at the heavenly messenger of death. We've had some people really close to the monastery within the past year pass away. Dee's husband, Stephen, was staying with us. Dee and Stephen staying with us at the monastery last winter for a while, and Stephen's passing in January was something that all of us participated in and grew a lot from. Being able to look real clearly at this very real part of our human condition. And I know that Dee has really used that to her benefit in her recollection and her practice, not being scared of it, not being scared of looking at the process very honestly. Just had a friend Laurie, who just dealt with the death of his brother just in the past few weeks. And that brings up for me memories of the different people that I've known who have passed away. I think starting for myself in my 20s and 30s, just in working with people who were dying and seeing friends and acquaintances pass away in the 80s. During the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, and then also with our father, who passed away in my early 30s. I think that was probably the time when it hit closest to home, really formed a strong impression. And these are times to really not shy away from looking at this as a reality of this existence. Because we have two options when we're faced with this as a recollection. One is to deny it and pretend it's not happening and to try and escape it and just push it under the rug, which is the way most of society works. Or we can use it to wake up as a reflection to as the condition of the world and something that we'll be facing ourselves at some point in time. Whether it's going to be happening soon or later on, we don't know. But the Buddha talks about using Maranasati, recollection of death, as a daily reflection. It's to help undermine that sense of permanence and stability in this human condition. And it the more I do it, actually, the more at ease I become with the idea. It's not something that's something we all gravitate to reflecting on without being pushed in a little bit or a lot. But I think that it's really good to see it not as something that's depressing. If when thinking about death, one starts to move into morbid or depressed or black states of mind, then it's not being used correctly. It's being held to personally. The idea of using death as a recollection is more towards developing a sense of who we are in nature. The more we allow ourselves to look at it, the more we see it, pretty much everywhere we are. That it's just part of this process of change, part of this process of impermanence that is natural. It's not anything that should be feared. That's the benefit of examining it on a regular basis, so we develop a sense of ease, much more of a sense of ease with it. I can remember kind of the first time I started thinking about it. It was I was just very clear, vivid memory of maybe I was in my late 20s or around 30 or so. I can't remember exactly, but just resting one afternoon, taking a rest in the afternoon, and all of a sudden found myself started thinking about what it would be like to die, what that's all about. And the resistance, the automatic resistance, started coming up very strongly, and I basically almost went into a state of panic, probably what would be close to a panic attack. Luckily, I was able to pull myself together enough to get up, and I had started a practice of meditation, although it was pretty much in the early days, but I just went into a quiet room and sat and tried to calm my my panic down, and my heart was pounding, but was able to kind of pull it together enough to force myself to really look at it and contemplate and say, well, what is this fear all about? Why am I scared of the thought of dying? Why, what is going on? And was able, just through a series of reflections, to ask myself, well, what is this all about? What is death anyway? What is it? And I was able to come to this understanding, very, initial, fleeting kind of understanding, that death itself, death of this human body, is really just one moment. And when it comes, it's going to be now. So really, death is now. All the rest of it is just a projection, a speculation, a guess, a fear, a worry. When it comes right down to it, it's one moment. The moment of death is, when it happens, it will be right now, and then it won't be. So what's to fear? I could spend the rest of my life worrying about it or think, trying to avoid it, but it doesn't seem like it's worth the energy to dwell in fear around it, because when it happens, there may be pain that I'll be not looking forward to or experiencing, or difficulties, or all the attendant things that come with it. But really, it's just a part of nature. It's another moment in nature, and that actually what's often more painful or difficult is the living. So I think that the Buddha really encourages us to contemplate this on a daily basis, to contemplate this ultimate nature of change, the change of what it is that we think of as ourselves, in this recollection of death. And again, not as a way of depressing us, but as a way of freeing us, because it's really when we open to and look at the truth of the way things are in this world, in this human realm, that we can let go of fear. The truth is, they say, the truth will set you free. So I'm not pretending that, I've conquered the fear of death. I think it's very deeply ingrained in all of us. But making it a constant recollection, I think, goes a long way to freeing us from the grips of fear and anxiety around aging, sickness, illness, and death, and what it represents in our minds. It's like there's the in the Buddhist tradition. There's this the being, sort of the equivalent of the Christian, Satan or devil, called Mara, although he's kind of a bit of a quite a bit of a different figure than the Christian Satan in so many ways. But Mara, among the many ways that he manifests as sort of the tempter or the one who's in charge of the conditioned realm and trying to keep us all within the realm of conditions, not to transcend them. But one of the ways his name, the name Mara, is translated is also death. Most of you know Ajahn Amaro. Amaro would mean the deathless. So Mara meaning death. And it's always, it's been interesting to me to, you know, when as you read through the suttas, and Mara appears at different times in the Buddha's life during the enlightenment process and after the enlightenment to try and see if he can trip up the Buddha and get him to, you know, fall into fear or lust or anger or anything else as a worldly condition. But the Buddha, in his awakened state, sees through it. And the phrase that the Buddha uses when confronting Mara and calling him on it, he says, "I know you, Mara. You know, you don't fool me. I know you, Mara." And in a way, it kind of makes me think, you know, if we use the translation of death as Mara, then he's also saying, "I know you, death, and therefore can't be fooled into fear or anxiety around the idea of death, because he's reached the deathless." So I think that, you know, we can apply that in our lives as well. If we contemplate old age, sickness, and death to the point of becoming familiar with it, then when it comes to be the time for people we care about, people that we love, to pass on or going through difficulties, or when it comes to be our time, you know, we'll hopefully have been working with this enough to be able to you know, look it squarely in the eye without fear and to be able to say, "I know you. I'm not scared." And the more we bring that contemplation of change, of impermanence, transience, of instability into our consciousness, the more we do that, the more we naturally will let go of holding on to these memories, these constructs of who we think we are, of who we were, of the way that we think it should be. And the more that allows us to let go of false refuges and to just be more present with the way things are right here and right now in their constantly changing nature. You start to maybe get a little bit of a hint of the idea not looking for stability in things that are inherently unstable. The Buddha encourages us strongly to not look for a sense of refuge or a sense of stability in the world, in things, because it is inherently unstable. Not to look for a sense of satisfaction in things that are inherently unsatisfactory. So we start to learn the process of relinquishment, of letting go, not holding on to, not clinging, when we see the transiency of all of this, of all of the world, of our experience, of our memories, of the constructs of what we think is a very solid and an unchanging reality. We can start to see through that illusion and let go into just being with things as they arise and as they cease, right here in this moment. And that's, I think that's the turning point that Lung Pao has been talking about the past couple of days, that as we bring that recollection of impermanence, of change, into the present moment, using these other reflections as a basis for allowing the mind to let go, then we start to have that ability to move deeply into a sense of inner peace that's based on not holding, not clinging, based on letting go into everything in this moment, just arising and ceasing right here in this very moment. And when we can do that, we see that it's just not worth holding on to, not worth trying to find a sense of refuge in the conditions that make up our lives. We see that it's not who we really are. So it's, again, oftentimes Buddhism is cast as a kind of a morbid reflection. Everything is suffering and it's all changing and what's the point of it all anyway? Kind of a, real existential downer. But if we hold it in the right way, use it as a proper reflection, then that really is what serves as the basis for freeing the heart. Really looking at what will free us, and it's the truth. We see it as it really is, not through the mists of our ignorance and of our desires. It's not a immediate process. It's one that waxes and wanes in our lives, we have to take the opportunities when it's staring us in the face to really use it, pick it up as a tool when we're being reminded of it full on. And then when things are quote-unquote going well, we actually have to really consciously bring it up as a recollection. It takes more effort. But it's one that is ultimately freeing and forms, I think, a solid base for our practice in freeing ourselves. So I think that's enough for this afternoon. I'll call it to close for people to contemplate the rest of the day.